Welcome back to your weekly episode of the Electric Podcast. Fred Lambert, your host, and I'm joined by Seth Winchaub. How you doing, Seth?
I'm sick as heck.
Yeah. You'll excuse Seth for having a little cold today, so if you sound a little bit rough.
My voice is a little harsh, but I'll be fine.
Yeah. And, sorry about that. There's a little echo right now. That should be fixed. Sorry about that. And, and you're preparing to go on a pretty long trip with your whole family in the Model X.
Yes, Model X, going to be all from New York to Florida. Going to hit lots of superchargers, probably about 25 hours total one way, and then 25 hours the other way. It's going to probably be a nightmare, but I'm prepared for it. Especially, a nightmare with the cold. It'll be lovely, lovely driving, I'm sure.
And would you imagine that Seth didn't get the autopilot, the new autopilot 2.0 update that is apparently magnificent? So he won't be even able to enjoy the new autopilot during this long trip and a lot of highways. So yeah, if someone from Tesla is listening right now, someone from the autopilot team, maybe just try to push the update to set overnight, or actually pretty much right now.
right now, actually.
Yeah, right now, otherwise, like you're going to leave tomorrow, you're going to have to... Yeah, that's going to be a dilemma. If you wake up tomorrow, you have to leave and you realize that you haven't updated yet, so you have to push the trip by an hour to get the autopilot, or you leave right away and don't have the autopilot.
Yeah, or if you get a bad update and you're stranded.
Yeah. Well, you know what?
I've never had one. I'm just, I've heard stories. Yeah.
But so my Model S, of course, doesn't have autopilot, so the new update doesn't do much for me. But I heard a ton of people just always complaining about the navigation system with the Tesla, just doing some stupid riding and stuff like that. And I never experienced that myself. Like I use the navigation system in my Tesla hundreds of times without any problem. But since the latest update, though, I have the same problem as everybody else. Like it's giving me just the stupidest things all the time. It keeps updating while I'm driving, even though like I'm driving in a place there's no traffic, there's no reason for me to reroute the route that I'm taking, and it's giving me like just take off the highway and go right back on the highway, like take the exit then go right back. It started giving me all that stuff the last update, so not sure if anyone else is experiencing that, but you're not alone if it's the case.
Yeah, the maps have actually gotten a little bit better. As long as you plan or need to stay on interstates or big roads, I think that it's accurate. If there's a small road between where you're trying to get, that's better. Tesla doesn't always take that. So I actually trust Tesla to get me to Florida, because basically like we get on an interstate and we just go south. But when we go to Vermont or we go in the woods anywhere, I will map on Tesla's map, and I will look at Google, and Google will usually have a quicker way.
Oh yeah,
yeah. So
I do that. Like when I have a long road ahead, I always do that. I double check with Google, but never had any issue with that until the update from 2 weeks ago. Really weird. But moving on to you have something to add, or?
Well, I was just going to say I turned on Wi-Fi because I never had Wi-Fi on the Model X to get updates, but that didn't work. And my Model X was in the shop, and I didn't get the update, which I thought was going to be for sure I would get an update at the shop.
Oh, yeah, that's weird, man. Yeah, because then only they check for update before they send it back, too.
Yeah, I almost always get an update when I go to the shop.
Yeah, maybe they're just crazy busy with the end of the quarter and... they forgot about checking for you.
Yeah.
Something like that. Yeah, so it is the end of the quarter. Last week, coming next week. And the big question for Tesla is what's going to be the production rate of the Model 3 exiting the quarter. Of course, the target was always 2,500 cars per week. And still very elusive in terms of trying to estimate the current production rate. But there were some good news this week. So if you've been following us, following our reporting on this, in February there was a big lull in new VINs being registered for the Model 3, but that really took off this month with pretty much like over 1,000 VINs being registered every week by Tesla. And early this week on Monday, that was again increased to over 2,000 VINs, and now just a few days later, within the same week, Tesla registered today over 2,500 new VINs. So it's not a perfect indication that the production is increasing, but it's a pretty good indication that that Tesla is really pushing to increase the production of the Model 3. And the highest VIN, which is not as good to look at as the rate at which they are registering new VINs, is now over 18,000, so getting close to 19,000. That doesn't mean in any way that Tesla has produced 18 to 19,000 vehicles, but it went from 12,000 VINs registered to over 18,000 within the month. So that's really the biggest increase we've seen yet. And it's coming really at the very end of the quarter. So my take on it is that we might going to see something similar that we saw last quarter when Tesla reported having reached a production rate of 1,000 a week based on extrapolating for the last few days of the month of December, yeah. And we might see something similar for March, I think.
So what do you think they're going to say, like 2,000, 3,000?
I'd be happy with anything over 2,000, really. If they do that, if they do it the last few days, the last week, they might very well be able to reach their target of 2,500. But I think anything that's over 2,000 is already where Model S and X combine are at. So if Tesla, even though the production rate is the production of the ramp up of the Model 3 is quite late already, I think that's really like a significant milestone to already reach the level of the Model S and X combined, which took years to reach that point, and Model 3 would have reached it in less than a year.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, basically they've doubled their output since the Model 3 started. Since Model S and X are probably relatively flat. So they've gone from the Model S and X production at the end of last year to double that in terms of numbers coming up now.
Yeah. And with this, like I said, we don't know for sure what they're going to come up with. But I think the most important thing is going to be actually the guidance for the 5,000 a week. So I think that's the big number to it. And even though with the delays, they were sticking to 5,000 by the end of Q2. So I think that's going to be what people are going to be looking for. Is Tesla going to be still confident about reaching that within the next 3 months? Or are they going to push that further?
And then what about profitability and CapEx? And
yeah, I think that's going to be linked to the 5,000. I think that's pretty much what it was, because the investment that they've been doing is for the 5,000. And what the 5,000 mean is that once they reach 5,000, they know exactly what it took for them to reach 5,000, and now they can better plan to how they double that to 10,000. So they know what kind of resources took them to get there, or what they had to optimize, and now they can build the second line for the 10,000 units per week, or whatever part of the production line they need to double to reach that. And so again, that's going to be, I think, the big point to look at. And of course, it's also the important thing for, I think Tesla ideally needs to be at 5,000 units per week when they hit the milestone for the federal tax credit. Because the higher the production rate is when they hit the 200,000 threshold to trigger the phase out of the federal tax credit, then the more they can take advantage of that phase out period of 3 to 6 months of the full credits team still being available to buyers. If they had 5,000 a week and they say like they keep maybe just 1,000 a week for the international market, whether it is Canada or at this point maybe they're going to start on the European markets, then they can have like 4,000 a week to just deliver to the US to maximize that credit. That'd be very great for Tesla buyers, I think.
Yeah, I think U.S. buyers, especially on the tail end of that two-quarter phase-out, will be a little bit bitter that cars are going to Canada and other places when they're trying to get in under the $7,500 tax credit.
Yeah, and they're still going to get the 35, if not, but higher the production rate is by the time they hit that threshold, the better it is. And we're starting to see that maybe Tesla is really trying to position itself to be able to hold back cars for a while until hit the threshold in the right quarter, because they just opened up the Model 3 orders in Canada this week. That's the next news that we're going to talk about, is Tesla started inviting the first Model 3 reservation holders to transfer the reservation into orders on the Canadian market. So they started earlier this week with employees, just like they did in the U.S. So employees in Canada also had a priority for the delivery, but just like unlike the in the U.S., it was just a few days since the production rate is already higher. And but then yesterday, Tesla started sending the invite to owners. So I got mine.
What color?
I got my my invite, but I didn't place the order because I'm waiting for all-wheel drive. And that's the thing. Even though the all-wheel drive, both the rear-wheel drive and long-range battery configuration and the all-wheel drive long-range battery configuration were both showing mid-2018. But once they opened the online configurator, only the first production long-range rear-wheel drive was made available, and the all-wheel drive still show mid-2018. So there was some speculation that they could open up both at the same time since they were both the same delivery window, but that's not the case. Though I'm pretty sure that we might be seeing it quite soon. So we'll keep an eye on that, and we might be able to order it soon, but it's gonna be in... it should be in the U.S. and Canada at the same time, so that's not like it's a Canadian exclusivity or anything like that, unless, like we just said, Tesla tried to hold back on U.S. delivery for a while in order to hit the milestone at the right time.
What do you think about the 20-inch wheels signaling a upcoming performance version, or one that coincides with the all-wheel drive?
Yeah, we forgot to put that in the... in the post about it, but that's a good point. Earlier this week, we learned that the 20-inch wheel for the Model 3 was added to Tesla's online store. And we speculated that it might be for the performance version, as I just mentioned. But Elon also said in the past that he just think the 20-inch wheels looks better on the Model 3 than the 19. So it might just be an aesthetic thing that people were asking for it. So there it is. But at the same time, it's fun to think about the performance version. But the performance version, Tesla really hasn't talked about it for over a year. So I'm a little bit concerned about that. If probably still in the plans, but not anytime soon. Otherwise, I think it would be like in the delivery window thing where you see the all-wheel drive, you see the standard battery, you see everything. I think they would have had it that. What do you think?
So the all-wheel drive version, does that have the same rear engine as the two-wheel drive version?
No, it's a smaller engine in the front.
But I mean, the rear engine is the same though, right?
Oh, yeah, I think so, yeah.
So the all-wheel drive is going to have a lot more performance just anyway.
Well, it should, yeah. It should have a higher total output because we recently learned that indeed the actual... current capacity of the battery pack is just way higher than what the rear-wheel drive inverter can take. So it can certainly like feed the full capacity of the rear-wheel drive and have excess power. So if it has a front-wheel drive motor also, then it will automatically have a higher output. So the battery pack is not a bottleneck right now. It might be, we don't know the capacity of the front motor, but it might end up being the bottleneck.
But if they keep the rear motor the same on the Model 3 as on the all-wheel drive as they do as the rear-wheel drive, that's already, what, 200, what is it, 250 horsepower?
I have 271 in mind.
Yeah, 271. So you're talking about, I don't know, what, another 100 or 200 horsepower?
Yeah, maybe 150. So
if it's 150, that you're talking about 400 horsepower in a small sedan. That's going to be a pretty...
Oh yeah, it's going to be a fun car.
It's going to be crazy car, sure. Actually.
Yeah, it's a lot lighter than the Model S too. Yeah, but yeah.
And that's the not performance version. So maybe they put another 270 in there, and then you have a 550 horsepower BMW M3 kind of vehicle.
Yeah, what I see Tesla doing, and that's complete speculation on my part. Don't try to read too much into it. But like you said, like there's a lot of potential with having a front motor too in terms of overall capacity. And it's getting like crazy close to the Model S, even though the Model S got a few updates that year, like the uncorking of the capacity gave it a little bit more pep. But I could see Tesla doing something where the software locked the capacity with the all-wheel drive. Like they put the all-wheel drive, you have all-wheel drive, so you have traction in all four wheels. Maybe it's not too expensive, maybe like a $4,000 thing or $3,000 thing, not like the $5,000 it used to be. And you just have a little bit more power, and you can have the performance version, which is the exact same car, but software lock, it unlocks more power, more overall power.
Yeah, that would be cool, and it would be so tempting, because like every time you were driving your car, you'd be like, this car has more power, I could just, you know, yeah. A couple thousand bucks on my credit card.
Yeah. I think it's going to be more than a couple thousand, though.
Right.
I mean, like just a $5,000 to $10,000 package, which would be just a profit margin way for Tesla to increase its profit margin. But I think it would make sense, because otherwise, like doing again a new configuration for the Model 3, and that's also one of the selling part of the Model 3. Like it has fewer configuration option than. Model S.
I mean, I guess the other option is they drop the horsepower in the rear engine to like, you know, 150 in the front to, you know, 150. Then you have a 300 horsepower vehicle. It's got, you know, power in all four wheels kind of equal. And theoretically, that would cost less.
Yeah. I'm not sure about the split between the front and back, but yeah, that's pretty much the idea. Like, you limit the you still have a higher capacity than just the rear-wheel drive. So, the actual cost of having a second motor is taken into account with more performance. But I think like for the most part, people want the dual motor because like you have a all-wheel drive capacity, which is just great for winter in terms of snow, ice, and stuff like that, which is often an overkill in a lot of places. Like it's not necessarily needed. Just with my Model S rear-wheel drive, I've been very impressed with what I capable of doing. I just went back to my parents' house this weekend, and my dad had trouble going up the driveway. We have at their house, they have like a big driveway, and it was still covered in snow and ice, and they have a lot of trouble with their SUV going up of it. And I had no issue with the rear-wheel drive Model S. It just went on top, and it's not like I have like extremely good tires either, so. I'm really impressed with the performance of it. Like so, in a lot of sense, I think going with the all-wheel drive is an overkill for me. But I'm buying it with what I just said in mind, with the fact like that I could have a lot more power in it, and that would be fun. But yeah, in terms of the Canadian launch of the Model 3, the price was the big thing. So they unveiled the price and. So, not many people are aware of this outside of Canada, but Tesla had some issues with the kinds of pricing, like tracking the U.S. pricing, even after, well...
Is that because of the exchange rate?
Yeah, they weren't updating with the exchange rate a lot, and of course it went up and down over the last few years. Lately, was tracking closer, so the price after taking into account the exchange rates was pretty close for the Model S, at least, to the U.S. prices. But it's the case, and it's really being reflected with the Model 3 here. It's tracking really close, just a few hundred bucks difference between the configuration and the overall base cost of $35,000 US, $45,600 for the Canadian prices, which is just a few hundred bucks difference after taking account the exchange rates. So that's a good news. And... the current configuration is pretty much... So I posted the full configurator, the Canadian configurator, on Electrek. But yeah, the instead of being $9,000 for US for the long range battery pack, it's $11,900, which is about the same thing in US dollars. So that's great. And overall, like I put my configuration without the all wheel drive, and it added up to 70,000 Canadian, which is about what I was expected to pay. So add the all-wheel drive. Worst case scenario is 5,000, I'd say. So that's $75,000 before accounting for the $8,000 incentive in Quebec.
Oh yeah, so, forgot about that.
Yeah.
What else did you get besides all-wheel?
What my configuration. Yeah, like I said, it's a configuration, but without the all-wheel drive, I just put black. I went with black.
Same.
Yeah. I look at the renders there. The silver metallic looked just so cool in the render, and it looks pretty cool too in real life. But it looks nothing like it is in the render. So, I'm not gonna go with that. And what I did was I went also with the standard wheels, with aero wheels, because. Oh, they look just fine. I prefer the look of the 19, the sports wheels. But since the 20 are now coming in, because you can order the 20 through the configurator. You can just order them through the Tesla's like aftermarket website, the Tesla store, they call it. So I figured if I want bigger wheels, like the bigger wheels look, I might as well go with the 20 inches. And have the option to go between the 18 and the 20 instead of the 18 and 19. So I thought that just makes sense.
Yeah.
And as for the only other option is the autopilot. And autopilot, I would went just with the enhanced autopilot, not the full fully self-driving. I feel like not worth paying the $4,000 difference. As long as they're just, you don't see the difference with the actual features being fed to
through software. It doesn't seem like it's right around the corner either. It seems like it might be a year or so out.
Yeah, so. And they do say some things like, "Oh yeah, but with the fully self-driving, we are enabling more cameras and things like that." But I'm not sure just how true that is. Like, it feels like they're still like working the. They want to make the enhanced autopilot as good as they can get, and I think if they need to use the other cameras for it, they're just gonna use it. So I'm not sure if that's still in the plans, because that was in the option since the very beginning, like in late 2018, they put that reference to the difference between the enhanced autopilot and full self-driving capability. But things have changed a lot since, and I think that might have been something that. They decided to not go with. Coming back though to the $8,000 in Quebec, I got a few inquiries about that, like people saying, "Oh, but in Quebec, yeah, you have these just like in Ontario with $75,000 limit on the cost of the car." But my understanding is that that's accounted for the base price of the vehicle. So even though I go over $75,000 with all the option, I still get the 8,000, I think. Like that's what's my understanding when I read the rules. So, even though it's like they said, it's after tax and a lot of it's not counted on the price after tax, but the Model 3 is showed as eligible in the list of vehicle that you can apply the $8,000 on it. And it was added also in BC this week. Was added also in Ontario, like we said. So shouldn't be any issue on that front, I think.
New York has something similar. I can't remember what the cap is. I could probably look it up.
Yeah, but it's pretty complicated though in New York. Like it's also account for the range, I think. And
right. So, yeah. But like it goes to 500. You know, whatever it is, you get 500 basically for any vehicle. But at some point, it can go up to 2,000 or whatever. But I think it might be under $50,000, so that's a good point. I wonder if it's a base price or configured price.
Yeah,
to look that up.
Okay, so the big missing piece right now is really just mainly the price of the all-wheel drive, which pretty curious about. But yeah, moving on, but staying with Tesla Model 3 news, just a fun quick post this week about the Tesla Model 3 being spotted on the Ford campus. So we had a little spy on the Ford campus this week, sending us a few pictures that a Model 3 was spotted being tested at the Ford Innovation Center.
So which isn't a surprise. We know this happens. Everybody does this with everybody else.
Yeah. Well, not all cars, of course. The Model 3 is certainly one top of the list for many automakers looking into furthering their electrification effort. And we've seen the car being tested by German automakers earlier this year. And now it's Ford's turn to put it to its pace. And they had a Model 3 with a VIN number in the 6,000s. Early 6,000s, which we've seen new cars being delivered in the recent weeks, anywhere between 6,000 and 10,000 or so. So it's not a big surprise.
You know, I just noticed something looking at the picture. They had tape over the cameras.
Yeah, yeah.
Like Zuckerberg on his MacBook. But I wonder if that's because they think Tesla's looking, you know, through the cameras and watching Ford test. You know, they're probably bringing into Ford's lab or something. And I wonder if they believe that Tesla can see through the front camera and see what's happening in there.
That might be it. But I also think that's it might not be testing it for the electric aspect, but more for the autopilot too.
That's true.
Because it was at the Innovation Center where they also do their they have their self-driving engineers based, some of them, because also based in California. But so it might be for that too. So maybe not. For sure, there's gonna be people putting tape on top of the driver-facing camera. So the Model 3 has the driver-facing camera now, which doesn't record anything right now. Based on the code that we've seen, I know a few of the Tesla hackers who hack into the software, and they said that there doesn't seem to be any code that collects any information from the driver-facing camera. Which wouldn't be the first car to have it. So GM has one in the Cadillac CT6, the one that has the Super Cruise, the GM's equivalent of Autopilot.
And that's to keep an eye on the eyeballs of the driver.
Exactly. So it's to monitor the driver's attention. So instead of having Tesla's nagging of put your hands on the wheel every 2 minutes or so, GM instead make sure that you are watching. If you're not watching, then they start their nagging procedures. What else for Tesla this week? Well, Elon Musk's multi-billion-dollar compensation package was officially approved by Tesla's shareholders. So that was no big surprise here. It was pretty much a done deal.
That's not a hard thing to, like, as a shareholder. It's, and I'm not a, I'm actually, I own one share, but if you are a shareholder, the deal is this: if I make you a ton of money, I get a ton of money. So if you're a shareholder, it's okay, that's not a big deal. That's all
The argument against it, and a few people came out against it. In terms of shareholders, there weren't that many. But there was one. There was the Norway's public fund, Norway's investment fund, which is just huge. They're insanely rich, and they are not the big Tesla shareholders, but they have a few millions of dollars worth of shares, and they came out against it. And their argument is not bad. It's because Elon Musk is already 20% owner of the stock, so he's already really invested into the valuation increasing. So adding more share to it shouldn't really be a big deal for him in terms of encouraging him to increase the shareholder value. But I guess the idea behind it is mainly because he's not being paid at all, in this. So that's the only way to compensate him is with stock option package. So it's just the only question is just how CEO is that right now anyway. So even those that take an actual salary, it normally dwarfs the compensation package, the stock option package. So in this case, it was just about like how generous should you be with the package. And shareholders were extremely generous because that thing, it could be worth easily over $50 billion. And if his current shares of Tesla stay the same, so his current share of Tesla, then he adds those, and his whole the worth of his stake in Tesla could be worth over $200 billion by the time all the option fully vest. But at that point, like every other shareholders will be crazy rich too, so it's not that big of a problem. It's not a problem at all, actually.
No.
But it makes people jealous, as usual. One thing that people misunderstood, I think, from it is that it would force him to still be CEO. And like it's easy to be confused since the actual package, it's called the 2018 CEO Performance Award. But he doesn't actually need to remain CEO in the clauses of the contract. He says that he can remain chairman of the board and product architect. I think that's chief product architect. He has a few different titles at Tesla, and CEO is not the requirement for it. But I don't think that there's any plan to replace him as CEO. But like, if they get an opportunity to have like a great CEO to come on board, well, I think Elon and the board would be open to just move Elon aside and let him focus on other things at Tesla and have someone take over the role.
I mean, that's more of a COO type of role that I think you're thinking of. I mean,
yeah. Yeah, because Tesla doesn't have a COO. So
and as far as CEO is concerned, Elon currently does like 16 jobs. So yeah. Like how many more companies is he going to come up with between now and then that would make him like, oh, I can't do the CEO job anymore? Like
that's what was so funny in the last call when he announced that John McNeil is going. John McNeil, president of sales and service. Hey, he just went, oh, he's going. We have no plans to replace him. I'm just going to take over his responsibilities. Right. Like, oh, shit. Like, you need that? You need to have more responsibility right now?
Right. You got all that free time.
Yeah. But, it's not, they were all sort of, they were vice president of sales and stuff. So I think the actual responsibilities of John McNeil were split up. It's not
right.
Like,
I think realistically his subordinates got his roles.
Yeah. It's more that like, if ultimately these are like big decisions to be made, it's going to go back to Elon anyway.
Right.
Like in other EV news this week, we had less of a good news, like not a good news at all. Some other makers are still trying to go after the fuel consumption standard in the U.S., and a decision should be coming pretty soon, and we expect it's going to be a bad one. Like, we're talking about the CAFE standard here, which should... That's something that should be a done deal. It was agreed upon between the industry and the Obama administration and the EPA back in 2012, requiring a fleet-wide average of fuel economy to reach over 50 miles per gallon by 2025. So your average fleet as an automaker need to well, actually, that's not even true. That's the thing. Officially, it's that, but it works based on credits. And if you actually account all the credit, the real world average will be closer to 36, I think.
Yeah, and it's not really like it's not really that hard to meet. Like, it wouldn't be.
Yeah. Well, it is if you only sell trucks and pickups and stuff like that. So that's the issue right now. So that's why Chrysler, Ford, GM would like to see it reduced, even though they already agreed to it.
But yeah, and also I'd note they revisited it in 2017, and you know they opened
a revision to it in 2017.
Right.
So now they're still in that revision, and by next month they need to decide if they're going to change it.
Right.
So there's no official revision of it yet. They are just currently looking into it. They open to revision right now.
And, right, and currently the U.S. is run by nut jobs, and Scott Pruitt, actually that's quoting a unnamed source at GM, but Scott Pruitt, who's the EPA administrator, seems to side with oil companies on every single issue, And yeah. like as crazy and insane as that sounds, like he's the EPA commissioner. Like it like baffles the mind.
Yeah. So this week we posted a story about it. Like, and the story is just an update on the current lobbying effort from the auto industry to have it revised. And the effort was first put forward by the Alliance of Automakers, which is their lobbying group, which include pretty much every automaker. There's two, like there's the Alliance, and then there's the Global Automaker Lobbying Group. And both together, they pretty much account for every automaker out there except for Tesla and maybe like Peugeot and what's the other French automaker aside from
Citroën?
Yes, it's Citroën, Peugeot, like PSA, the PSA group.
Right. Also, yeah. I think I read that Honda's not in or something. I don't know.
No, Honda is a global automaker. It's not Alliance, but it's a global automaker lobbying group. Anyway, so through that group, the effort is clear: is that we cannot sell, we're not able to sell electric vehicles to the masses. It's too hard. Gas is too cheap. We can do it. So reduce the standard so that we can still sell vehicles that pollutes and destroy the environment and kill people, literally. Like people dies from the emission that those cars emit.
Hey, but you know what? They can make gas more expensive.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. So everybody so that's just an incentive for them to produce more electric vehicles. All right, which is always great. But there's too many different complicated incentives to do it. The $7,500 tax credit is not better. There's plenty of flawed aspect to that program. Then you have this one, which also has flawed aspect to just increase the fleet-wide average of the fuel economy. So, of course, a tax on gas, which is would pretty much be a tax on carbon. So a tax on carbon would be just the best-case scenario because it would make more sense.
And a tax on gas would raise a lot of money, too.
Yeah, and the tax of gas would just be a different implementation of that, but it will make also more sense than that. But anyway, right now that's what we have, and we have in place, and with Trump in power and Scott Pruitt at the EPA, the best you can hope for is maintaining what we already gained, what we already had, which was the CAFE standard. And now you're pushing to remove that since Trump is in power. And what changed this week is that Mary Barras, the GM CEO, reportedly met with Trump's administration and, with the EPA directly. And recently they've been saying that we are all in electric vehicles. And the push to increase the tax credit to the federal tax credit, the push for that, which is great in a sense. Of course, it's because they're gonna run out soon. So they just like Tesla, they know that they're not gonna be competitive if they run out before everyone else, and they're gonna run out just a few months after, a few quarters maybe after Tesla. And and they are backing the Alliance effort. So they're still in the Alliance and they are backing the direct effort to reduce that. But so we wrote an article about that and we quickly got a call from GM after that, not happy about the article. But ultimately we tried to convince them we understand that you're not happy with it, but as long as you don't back out of the Alliance and you don't remove your support to revise the CAFE standard, then there's nothing we can do. We have to come down on this because ultimately it's just gonna have a worse impact on the environment than this already is. And we understand where they're coming from. They're a public company. They have a responsibility to their shareholders to make money, and the money right now is in trucks and pickups and SUVs and all those stuff. And that's where the gross margin is, and essentially that's where also the emissions are.
Yeah. So their official PR standpoint is that they're in this alliance because they do a lot of things, not just emission standards. And that may be true. Like they do safety stuff, and they do all kinds of other stuff. But you know, GM's standpoint is that they come at this from a, we just want one regulation. We don't want a regulation in California and the ZEV states and then another regulation in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And they want simplicity and they want to know what the future holds so they can make better plans. And that, you can almost like say, okay, that seems like a reasonable excuse. But like...
Yeah, that's the point. It's a reasonable excuse.
Right. That's what exactly. It's like, you know, it's as far as they need to go. But, you know, you have to like, hey, like, you know, as an EV buyer, like I give a, you know, I care about the environment. I care about the world. Why do I have to like, why do I have to sell out to this company who's, or why would I buy a car from this company that's, you know, pushing the whole industry to sell more SUVs? Yeah. Like they don't understand that. Like they think the consumers aren't aware of what, you know, they just GM commercials and that's all consumers care about. But informed consumers, which I think a lot of our readers are, can't buy a GM car knowing that the whole company is pushing for, you know, fewer standards on carbon emissions, and that, you know, that there's all the, you know, like the ignition switch blowing up and killing the EV1 and all the other stuff in the past that, you know, that,
yeah.
That or the auto dealers association, like there's plenty of reasons to hate GM.
Yeah,
this would be like a reason to not hate GM if they like came out of this group. But
yeah, look, coming back to your point, like having just like that's what their argument on how they're pushing EPA to force California to adhere to a federal standard instead of pushing. And it makes sense. Like, of course, you want as uniform regulation as possible, just for being more just for the simplistic sake. But it just so happened that California standard is more aggressive than the rest of the U.S. and the federal standard. So it just sounds like an excuse to lower the standard to me, at least. And I think to most people, it sounds, at least in the environmental group hub there, it sounds like that. So that's the main issue. And my point with their argument that, oh, the alliance do what the alliance wants, and we are part of it, not just for the CAFE standard push, but for the other aspect that the alliance does lobbying for. My point is that doesn't stop you to come out publicly and say that even though we're part of the alliance, we don't agree on them pushing to have the CAFE standard being reduced, and they're not willing to do that. So shame on you, GM, for not being willing to do that, if that's really what you think. Maybe it's not what you think, and we'll see about that.
Shame on them anyway. Like,
yeah.
They really need to get their act together. They have a really good car. They probably have a couple more really good EVs coming out. It's a shame that their, you know, upper brass are such knuckleheads.
Yeah.
So moving on to Porsche.
Yeah. So Porsche this week. Porsche tried to stay in the EV news cycle since they don't have a car on the market yet. They're always pushing like new interviews with executives about EVs. They are trying to show new prototypes and stuff. And this week they shared a bunch of images of the latest Mission E prototype. So officially they have only been showing the one that we saw back in 2015, like the white stunning concept Mission E vehicles, which is a great car, but that's not what you're actually going to have as a production vehicle that you can buy. And while it's still not it either yet, a more recent prototype has been is within those pictures, and we don't learn much of anything new, but we do see the front trunk for the first time. So it has a front trunk and it looks like it's a decent size. It's nothing like a Model S or your X or anything like that, but it's a lot bigger than the one we saw in the Hi-Pace a few weeks back.
Yeah, Jaguar's iPad holder.
Yeah, yeah, it's pretty. You can put a folder in it, and that's it. So this one looks like a decent sized briefcase could fit in it. They showed a few like a teaser image of a like up close shot of the headlights and stuff like that. So you can check that out on the website, but it's nothing too impressive. For some reason, they showed the charge port too, but it only featured like the Type 2 Mini Keys plug.
Yeah, there's no DC charging on that, unless there's another port. Some automakers put the port in the front.
Yeah, or it's just not the the final charge port either. Right. Cause, so with those prototypes, sometimes automakers will just test, will build a prototype just to test one specific aspect of the car, whether it is like the powertrain or the aerodynamics, the features of the car, or the sound level of the interior, something like that. So for certain stuff, you don't need other features. And it's that, or their promised 800-volt, 250-kilowatts charging station is not, it's not ready yet. One or the other.
It could be both.
Yeah.
It's well, funny that Porsche has to be leak.
It has to be ready, because that's like that's the feature that you've been hammering for the marketing ever since. Like, we're going to have the best charging option of any electric automakers and stuff like that. So if they don't deliver on that, it's like, ooh.
Yeah. And then, of course, Tesla's chargers are not sustainable in Porsche's eyes.
Yeah. Well, just before we go to that, one last thing we saw from those prototypes is that it has a B-pillar and a big B-pillar. Which makes it looks like the suicide doors of the Mission E are going away, most likely. So if that's a good thing, that's a bad thing, that's up to you. But suicide doors just looks cool. But the structural integrity of the vehicle is just much stronger with the B-pillar. So, but you can still have suicide doors with a B-pillar, though. Like it's not like wide open interior without it, but... You're like what makes a suicide door is that the fact that they open on the different like axes,
right? Like it's, the BMW i3 for instance has kind of suicide doors, but
there's still a B pillar on the i3, right? There's still like a door frame on it.
You know, I can't even think. I don't even know. I've been in 10 times, but
yeah, I don't remember either.
They are a little bit more inconvenient. Like if your kids are getting out of the back seat, you have to open the front door. But I don't know if all suicide doors are going to work like that.
Yeah. Well, the picture they showed doesn't have the door. It just have the chassis. So that's what I was thinking. But either way. Yeah, coming back to the charging. I screwed your segue. Sorry about that.
Sorry.
One of the board members, Lutz Mexke, deputy chairman of Porsche's board, commented this week on the... on the Porsche charging network effort. So we know that the Porsche machine is going to have a 250 kilowatt charging capacity, but now they're also building the charging network to charge at that capacity. And during a press event, the executive commented on the difference between that network, which in Europe is going to be Ionity, and in the US is going to be part of Electrify America's effort that as part of the Volkswagen settlement for the Dieselgate scandal. And the big difference is going to be in terms of cost. So the guy said that Tesla's business model wasn't sustainable, which is fair, since, of course, Tesla is not trying for the supercharger network to be a business at all. Like, it's just something to support its fleet. Porsche, on the other hand, is going to make it a profit center, they say. Where it's starting, so everything is fair, I think, in the article, up to the point where he's starting to talk about it costing as much as gasoline, like as much as refueling a gasoline car. That's more worrying to me. Like, even if you're going for a profit center, I don't think you need to charge as much as that, right?
Now, we know EV costs per mile are way less than gasoline. There's a lot of room for, I mean, unless these charging stations cost, you know, millions of dollars each, there's no way you couldn't make money on charging vehicles. There's plenty of margin. I mean, a lot of places it's double per mile, the cost for electricity versus gasoline. So charging as much as gasoline seems insane. Plus, I mean, like, think about, like, you have to pay to get the gas from, you know, the tanker or the, you know, refinery to the gas station. It's like once you set up an electric charger, like the only costs are demand charges, and that And that's, you know.
You mean once you amortize the cost of actually building the station, then you have just a few like low maintenance costs and the electricity rates.
Right.
But I mean, which can vary a lot per region, though. That's,
right.
That can be.
But gas stations, like those aren't cheap to be built either. You got to get a big tank. Yeah, you got to drill it in the ground. You got to all permitting, all this. Like, it's a lot
more
of work.
More maintenance, too. A lot more maintenance than charging stations.
Way more maintenance. Yeah. It's easy to see how charging networks can be profitable.
And but in short term, like, the cost of building the network is, of course, the biggest cost here. In terms of INET, we're talking when they submitted the project, they were talking about like 250,000 euros, I think, per stations. So that's a big cost to start with. So you have to take that into account. And that's what scares me the most, because when we talked about building a profitable charging network, I think one of the biggest points to make it profitable is to have a high use rate per, not just per station, but per stall, per charge point.
Right.
So that's was the big difference between Tesla and the third-party charging network, which are right now the only example that we have of a charging network that aims to be profitable. Those are the third-party. You know, we're talking about ChargePoint. We're talking about EVgo. We're talking about Blink and all those guys. And those guys just put a few charge points, two or three best ones, like four per station, because they want to have a high use rate per station. They want all the charge point to be used as often as possible. And if you put 8, 12, now Tesla is doing 24, 40, 50 charge point per station. Of course, you're going to have like a high number of charge point that's not going to use most of the time, because those are there for the peak diamond time. And you want to try to make sure that no one arrives at the station and doesn't have a charge point, which could be a big issue. And so if you're going to make that a profit center, like Porsche is saying right now, then you're going to have to go with the lower charge point per station goal. And so that's what worries me the most, because INET said that they're going to do about 6 charge point per station, which is not that bad, though I would like to see a higher number, closer to 10, 12. But recently they showed their latest designs for the stations, and it had 12 charge point per station, which was very encouraging. But now I'm not so sure that's going to be the point.
Yeah, I mean, on a high level, this is kind of a chicken or egg problem, because you don't want to buy an electric car unless there's charging stations out there, but you can't build a charging station if there's no electric vehicles. So, you know, things like the Volkswagen settlement help, you know, artificially create, you know, not demand, but put money towards building these things.
Yeah.
You know, it would be nice if Chevy, you know, put some money into all this stuff, or, you know, other electric vehicle manufacturers kind of helped start these things up. You know, I always give the example, you can't drive a Chevy Bolt between Los Angeles and Phoenix, like two high states, because there's hundreds of fast charging places in LA because it's a high density area, and there's a bunch of fast charging in Phoenix because it's a high density area. But no, like, these idiots, like why won't you put one in the center point between the two places, so somebody can drive between LA and Phoenix, where like a lot of people do that. Mm-hmm. But you know, these companies that are incentivized by population density don't necessarily think like a, you know, like a car company would. And that's kind of like why Tesla has a huge advantage, because Tesla thinking like a car company is like, hey, our drivers want to go cross country. We got to put these things between cities, not in the middle of cities. And, you know, that I think it's an inherent advantage.
That's what bothers me the most about Porsche's comments there, because if you're going to model your charging infrastructure on an existing network, it has to be the Tesla Supercharger network. It's the most successful one, the one that makes more sense. The only thing that you just don't do is that you don't go like Tesla does and say, we never gonna make it a profit center, which is Tesla was claiming. That, I think, is a mistake. Like, eventually, maybe you should aim to make it a profit center and make it part of your global solution and things like that. But what Porsche said instead is that we're going to charge from the get-go. We're going to try to make it gasoline. So they went completely the other way instead of just model themselves against the most successful charging network and just make the little difference of them. And eventually, we're going to try to just turn the knob a little bit and try to make a few bucks from it.
Yeah, it would be interesting to see Tesla, if they'd be open to letting other companies charge. Originally, it seemed like Tesla was open, like they were willing to share their charging patents, but not more and more, it seems like they want to use their charging network as a long-term strategic advantage.
Yeah, well.
Which, you know, that's natural.
Yeah, and I think like the main issue with that, too, is that so since not every automakers are just making cars that charge at the same charge rate, and things like that. So you don't want to like to accept cars on your network that charge slower than your cars,
right?
Because they're gonna take more time, and so they're gonna slow the whole thing down for your owners just because they're charging charging capacity of the car is not strong enough.
Right.
But anyway, we still have a few minutes, and we wanted to talk quickly about the Boring Company because it was some Boring Company news this week. And it's starting to get exciting for the Boring Company, which almost started as a joke, and now it might be a big transit infrastructure company in the U.S. Might be. Because the two big news this week was that we reported last year that Tesla was Boring Company, Elon Musk's Boring Company, was bidding on a project in Chicago to have a transit system between the airport and downtown. Like, there's a big need for that in Chicago because the airport is nothing close to where most people want to go when they come in. And right now, they rely on taxis and Ubers, and it can be quite expensive. So they want a new transit system, and they sent out a request for proposal, and they received 4 proposals. And they canceled the 2 that were refused, and now it's up to the 2 finalists. One of them is the Boring Company with the loop. So that's the important part. So they have 2 different systems right now that they're trying to make more clear. They have the Hyperloop, which we know a lot about, like we reported, because there's a lot of different companies working on it. And there's the loop, which is actually just like a Hyperloop, but they don't reduce the pressures inside the tunnels.
Because it's a short distance. You don't need to go that fast.
Yeah, it's for a shorter distance. So it's the same thing. You move on electric skates. You move either like a passenger's car or...
pods.
Pods, which you can put passengers and cyclists in them. Or you put cars on electric skate, but that seems to have taken a step back on it. Like they're now focusing for pedestrians and cyclists. So it's going to be more of those pods that move inside the tunnels on electric propulsion. So that's a good thing. It's all electric. But their system is the finalist now, and they're going to have until May to do a more concrete proposal, and then they're going to be approved or not. If they are approved for it, they don't get any public fund. It's not like they get like $1 billion investment and they can deliver the system. It's going to have to be privately funded, and then they're going to pay themselves because they're going to have all the rights for the actual fares to go from the airport to downtown. And that leads us to the other Boring Company news this week, is that the unveiled the actual project on the East Coast, or at least part of it. They're gonna have a first. At first it was supposed to be a Hyperloop, a whole East Coast Hyperloop from Washington to New York. But now they're gonna focus on the first leg, which is gonna be Washington Baltimore, and it's not gonna be a Hyperloop. It's gonna be a loop, just like we described for Chicago. But that's what is really interesting about the project, is that they're going to build it to the specification of the Hyperloop, but make it a loop. So eventually, if the project continues and grows beyond Washington, Baltimore, and go all the way to New York and other cities in between and everything, then they could depressurize the tunnels and turn it into a hyperloop and have it go faster between all the locations, which I thought was pretty cool, right?
Yeah, that's really cool. I'm about to drive down through Washington, and man, it would be so much easier and funner and cooler to sit in a little pod reading a book, going do it 300, 400 miles per hour.
Yeah, that would be with the hyperloop. Right now, with the loop between Washington and Baltimore, they're talking about 125.
That's still pretty not so bad. Like,
yeah,
100 miles is way better.
They're talking about making Washington Baltimore in 15 minutes. So that's pretty good. Like 35 miles in 15 minutes, and those 35 miles are like normally it's pretty busy on the
very congested
Baltimore Washington the parkway between Baltimore and Washington.
Yep.
So this week what they did is that they released like all the details of the plan, what they want to do. They want pretty much to reassure the public that they're gonna dig underneath the existing highway, so it's not to disturb anyone, and also they dig deep enough not to disturb anything at the ground level, so you don't even know that they are going under you. And they say that they are working with the city of Washington and the city of Baltimore to figure out where are the best places to put the stations, so where you can get in and out of the loop. And that's pretty much it. There weren't that many surprises. They also reiterated the fact that it's going to be aimed at pedestrians and cyclists. And they also said that they can do it in 12 to 20 months. At 35-mile tunnels in 12 to 20 months. So that's a Boring Company timeline, which we assume is the same as a Elon Musk timeline, which we assume is pretty optimistic. So do what you want with that. But that's the construction time. 12 to 20 months construction time. It doesn't mean that, like, I don't think the construction started on that project yet. And they listed like half a dozen, even more, like maybe even a dozen different government agencies that they need approval from to make their project happen. So there's a lot of red tapes. It's not going to be available tomorrow.
No.
And they also say that the 12 to 20 months depend on the speed of the boring machine, how they get the speed going. So it sounds like they haven't figured it out yet either. Last we heard, they were still trying to beat a snail. So
right.
The speed of a snail.
And I wonder, like, what the rock underneath, you know, what they're digging through. I wonder if that matters or how much that matters. Like, I don't know.
Yeah,
I don't
know. It should be pretty consistent if you go at this, and they go deeper too. Like they go at least 30 feet in the ground, mm-hmm. but they change the how deep they go based on what they're going through. I think, like, if they say, "Oh, we can go deeper, or we can go higher."
The thing about that though is, like, if it's hyperloop or even 100 miles per hour, you can't like go up and down too much. Like you're going really fast. If there's any kind of turns up, down, left, right, they're going to be really noticeable. And like hyperloop speeds, you almost can't have any kind of change of direction, because if you're going 600 miles per hour through that thing and, you know, there's a dip, you know, that's enough G's to like kill you. So
yeah, that's why they might just like depressurize like portion of the tunnels, and you can go faster certain portion and a slower order thing.
And you would have to have like some sort of like vacuum, like you'd have to go through, I don't know, it'd be weird.
Yeah, well, it's not a complete vacuum either, the hyperloop. Like, it's just like a lower pressure environment similar to what you have in planes when you fly high altitude,
right?
Yeah, so it doesn't need to be perfect, so maybe they can focus on that area and just have pumps and depressurize quickly, and then something go through because there's a section that makes sense for it.
Yeah, it'll be like those inflatable tennis courts where you can just like right through their door.
Yeah. It's a very ambitious project. Like, it's nothing we've seen before. Like we ever seen before. It's like, I want to say it's more ambitious than a high speed train, but like
it's almost less ambitious, because a high speed train you have to like take
right away. You have to in French, it's exproprié when you take land from someone. What do you call that?
It's like eminent domain.
Eminent domain.
Yeah. So basically, like, we're the government. It's a bigger cause. You got to move, and we'll give you some money.
So going in the tunnel, it should be easier at that point, and that's why they do it, and then that's why they think they can do it cheaper. And by the way, just like Chicago, that's also they plan to have that privately funded. So it's not, they're not asking for public money or anything. They're just asking for support for the project to, like, put some pressures on the legislators and everyone that needs to put their stamp on it.
Right.
Other than that, like, they're not asking for money. Yes, they're selling plenty of hats and flamethrowers to finance it. No, like, people are taking that seriously, but I think that's a joke. Like, he keeps saying it, but it has to be a joke, and he has millions and if not billions to put into it. That's something I always say, like, for especially to the people that are short Tesla and everything like that. Like, don't bet again Elon Musk's ability to raise capital. He's perfectly capable to raise capital when needed, and I think the borrowing company is going to ultimately be the biggest example of that, because they have no product aside from the hats and the flamethrowers. They have no products to show for, just like a whole boring machine that they're trying to tinker with. But their ability would be like, oh, we can deliver on that. Just raise money for the specific project and just get it done. Get it done.
And then, so one last eulogy for today. We got the news just today that the Facebook Tesla website, or the Tesla Facebook presence, is now dead.
Yeah, they killed it. They killed it because of Trump.
Right, because... you know, Elon didn't know that they had a Facebook page, and
yeah,
like, oh, it's ugly. I hate Facebook. I hate Zuckerberg.
He's making it sound like it's because of the Trump campaign thing that not exactly the Trump campaign, but the scandal right now that is going on.
It always
on
comes back to Trump.
Yeah, that ultimately comes back to Trump, because they exploited the Facebook API to collect information, and now there's a big, like, delete Facebook campaign and everything, and that's pretty much why they deleted the pages. But I think it's just a ruse, and Elon Musk has a big penchant for Twitter, and and he's using that to just screw Facebook and go push for Twitter, I think. Because we know that he used Twitter a lot, and apparently, like you said, didn't even know about Tesla having a Facebook page. But the interesting part in that is that, like, Tesla is big on social media, because they don't have traditional advertising, so they rely on their social media presence to just, like, push their marketing content, which can be their own blogs and their own videos about their events and stuff like that. Or just third-party articles, like sometimes our articles were on Tesla's Twitter or Facebook page and stuff like that. So now that's not going to be the pace on Facebook anymore. And they had millions. They had millions of followers. And
I don't know if that was a great idea. Like, I think that might have been one of Elon Musk's not best ideas. Like, I hate Facebook too. Like, I definitely hate it. But, like, the reality is like, there's no good replacement for it right now.
Yeah.
And, like, a lot of our readers are because of Facebook. Like, people just read us on Facebook. So that sucks, because Facebook sucks, but...
Yeah, because the problem, like, so Tesla, like, 2 million followers, something like that, on Facebook, and they could post one of our articles, just to give you an impression, because of just how screwed up Facebook is about trying to get you to pay to promote your stuff. Tesla could post something, and we'd get 20,000 views from it. Like, 20,000
not even sometimes.
Yeah, and that. But then another post would get like 200,000 views for it, just because for some reason, whatever, like, Facebook decided this one instead of this one. So they have, like, way too much control on what they can show to your followers. So that might be a reason for it. But ultimately, like you said, I think it's going to be a bad move in terms of marketing, because when you have a Tesla event, like Tesla on its own, without any advertising, anything, they have a product launch, and then they put it on YouTube, they put it on Facebook, they put it on Twitter, they put it in everything, and it becomes viral. And now they just have one fewer outlet to do that with.
Yeah.
But no one's going to cry over that, except maybe Zuckerberg. So that's pretty much it, guys. We went a bit over time, almost 10 minutes this episode. What happened? And thanks for listening. Thanks for watching on Facebook, on YouTube. Oh, it's Friday. I'm starting to get tired. And thanks to all our Patreon supporters. You can go to patreon.com/electric to support us, and you can get great gear, apparels, and that's it. Thanks, Ed.
Have a good one. See you next week.
Have a good trip to Florida.
Oh, yeah.
Bye-bye.